Los Angeles has some of the highest priced real estate in the country. Add to that the tensions of race and gentrification in changing neighborhoods, and things can get combustible pretty quickly. For today's Crime in the City, our profiles of crime writers and the places they write about, Karen Grigsby Bates from NPR's Code Switch team met up with Rachel Housel Hall. In her new crime series, Hall introduces readers to a shadowy side of LA.
Rachel Housel Hall is easing her big laurel green Mercedes sedan through the streets of Los Angeles. A slim woman with big eyes, Hall says this Benz is her dream car, the thing she'd planned to buy for herself once she'd become a successful writer, probably around age 50.
And then when I was 33 years old, I was diagnosed with a rare type of breast cancer, and I was pregnant, and it was terrifying.
She had a great team of doctors and lots of family support, and she survived to deliver a healthy daughter who's now 10. But after her medical crisis, Hall emerged with some newfound direction. No more waiting, whether it's her dream car or a writing career. Before cancer, Hall had really wanted to write a detective novel, but was afraid to because she wasn't a cop. What if she got something wrong? But facing your own mortality changed everything.
Having faced that, that's the biggest fear anyone could have. It's like, okay, writing a book, that's not scary. I can do that. And that's when I started Land of Shadows, actually.
Land of Shadows features Hall's heroine, homicide detective Eloise Norton. Known as Lou, Norton is scary smart, fiercely ambitious, and mostly able to shrug off the slings and arrows she sometimes receives as the only woman and the only African-American on her homicide detail. The book opens when Lou is called to a construction site in South L.A. to investigate an unidentified teen girl's death. Lou suspects the real estate mogul building the complex may be involved, but also may have ties to the unsolved disappearance of Lou's own sister 2 decades earlier. Whether she can detach herself from her personal past to effectively investigate the current death drives the plot.
So we're very happy to have Rachel here with us tonight. Please welcome Rachel Hall.
At a reading at Esawen Books in the cultural heart of Black L.A., Hall tells the audience Lou Norton reminded her of an earlier character she'd admired in the 1991 movie Silence of the Lambs. She says Jodie Foster's FBI agent, Clarice Starling, and Lou Norton are poised and confident, but they come from hard beginnings, which can be a sore spot. Hall tells them she kept in mind this scene in which Dr. Hannibal Lecter quickly deconstructs Starling when she tries to profile him.
She sits down with Hannibal and he quickly tells her about herself.
Do you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube. Good nutrition's given you some length of bone, but you're not more than one generation from poor wire trash, are you, Agent Starling?
And I wanted, as I created Lou, I wanted her to have some of that. Yes.
She meant she wanted Lou to have come from the same kind of financially pinched childhood Agent Starling had, and, through her own hard work and drive, to get to carry a gold badge and a gun. But just as Hannibal Lecter could figure out Agent Starling's West Virginia roots, some people still see Lou Norton as the tall black girl from the jungle. The jungle, as residents and cops often sardonically call it, is Lou's old neighborhood, although now it's called something else. At Esawen, Hall reads from Lou's depiction of the jungle for her audience as they nod in recognition.
Baldwin Village was the government name for my old neighborhood, but regular people knew it as the jungle. It used to be a nice place to live back in the 60s, a neighborhood boasting twisty streets lined with banana palms, roomy apartments, and swimming pools.
Hall's description is spot on because she knows the neighborhood as well as Lou Norton does.
We are on Santo Tomas and Nicolette Avenue in the Jim Gillian Park, across from where I grew up as a kid.
This sunny park is just opposite the second-story jungle apartment young Rachel Housel lived in growing up. In the 60s, she says, it was nicknamed the jungle because of the lush tropical foliage that surrounded each of the area's garden apartment buildings.
And then late 70s came PCP and gang members, and it took on a whole new different name, the jungle. And it got a little wild because of drug dealing and gang banging and all the rest of it.
Hall's parents kept a very close eye on her and her 3 siblings, filling their time with church, music lessons, and academic competitions. They were the Cleaver family, only black and in a Section 8 neighborhood. It's the same neighborhood Lou Norton left and now patrols. When grim stuff happens here, she manages to keep her distance with cynicism. Hall reads how Lou reacts when her boss calls to tell her about the Jane Doe hanging in a condominium closet.
In this city, Jane Does were always found hanging around, in closets, off bridges, and shower stalls. Yeah, a security guard found her in one of those condos over on Santa Rosalia near the jungle, the one still under construction. You know I'm right. I had started to lift my right knee, but froze. My grip tightened around the phone because, yeah, I knew Santa Rosalia. And yeah, I knew the jungle. From age 3 and on to my 18th birthday, I had lived in that part of Black Los Angeles. Worse, my big sister Victoria had been snatched off those streets, never be seen again. I hated the jungle, and yet I had never left.
Part of the reason she patrols it now is to try to keep other girls safe. Rachel Hall herself lives not far from the jungle, but it's obvious the short drive there puts one in a very different part of Black L.A. Her neighborhood, View Park, is largely unknown to people who don't live here. The houses are nestled in the hills that rise just above Hall's childhood home. She says she used to look up at them through her kitchen window and dream as she washed the dishes.
I grew up, you know, in the jungle looking at, you know, very big homes on the hills, and I knew Black folks lived there, and I knew that they were wealthy, and I aspired to that, and I wanted to be up that hill.
And now she is.
David and I, on our wedding day.
Hall's butter yellow living room is hung with family portraits. Here are her siblings, her parents, her wedding pictures, and a photo of her and husband David in the delivery room, beaming as they display their just-born daughter, Maya. There's a piano she plays when she wants to relax, and a window seat she likes to sit in when she writes.
I start my drafts in longhand. I write on legal pads. I love pencils and pens.
Hall never gets writer's block. She says as a working mother, wife, and cancer survivor, she doesn't have time for it. Instead, Rachel Housel Hall is spending her time on what counts, enjoying her family and writing novels that, via Detective Lou Norton, make people rethink what they think they know about South Los Angeles. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The new debut novel by Chris Leslie Heinen takes its title, Ride Around Shining, from a 2006 song by the hip-hop duo Clips. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says that there are even older sources for this story of newfound wealth and a disastrous fall.
Most sports novels are about the aspiration to excel physically, to run faster, stretch out one's arms farther. The really cool thing about Ride Around Shining, a debut novel by Chris Leslie Heinen, is that it doesn't stick to that familiar rule book. Even though it's set in the world of pro basketball, our narrator here is not the guy who aspires to be a great player. Rather, he's the guy who aspires to be a great suck-up to the great player. Jess, as our narrator is called, is a white-bread grad student, finishing his second useless degree. One day, he hears that a player for the Portland Trail Blazers named Khalif West is looking for a chauffeur, and Jess lands the job. Thus begins Jess's life of eager servitude, driving Khalif around in his entry-level Jag, waiting on the party guests who swarm into Khalif's McMansion on weekends, and even helping Khalif to dress, choosing from his array of beautiful suits in pearl gray, honey butter, and pinstripe silver. If your literary illusion antennae have begun twitching, you've read your Fitzgerald. This novel about nouveau riche excess, social class, and hero worship references The Great Gatsby on practically every page, beginning with Jess's retrospective Nick Carraway-like narration, as well as that premise of a white chauffeur driving around his rich black passenger. That's a scene that mirrors the famous Queensboro Bridge passage in Gatsby. But Gatsby isn't the only great book that Leslie Heinen cites. There's a bit of Othello lurking in a subplot about the scheming Jess's crush on Khalif's white wife, Antonia. And in Jess's tall tales about his own background and the wily way he sets in motion an accident via ice sculpture to sideline Khalif early in the novel, the Ripley stories by suspense master Patricia Highsmith spring to mind. Sometimes all this breathless literary sampling overwhelms Leslie Heinen's own voice and plot, giving his story a contrived Final Jeopardy question feel. But in its calmer, more assured moments, Ride Around Shining lays claim to being an interesting novel on its own terms, offering some fresh takes on those big American topics of race, class, manhood, and meritocracy. Race, in particular, enters into even the most casual of interactions between Jess and his employer, Khalif, who sometimes seem to be developing a genuine friendship. Other times, Jess tells us, I felt just as sure we weren't really friends at all, that he was having me on. Maybe he'd just grown accustomed to the queer allegiances of white boys tired of their own skin. The most compelling moments here are the crowded party scenes where Jess finds himself the lone non-basketball player and usually the only white guy, Chalk as he's called, in the room. Occasionally, he's allowed into the conversations, but the black players are always quick to let him know when he's misstepped. Listen to this snippet of conversation at a house party, where the question of who's on the inside and who's on the outside, not only at the party, but in America, becomes especially tangled. Jess spots one of those arcade games outfitted with plastic rifles, so he asks his host, an old basketball player nicknamed the Pharaoh, if he hunts. The Pharaoh snorts. Who am I, Colin Powell? Jess tells us that I was about to banish myself to silence when the Pharaoh shook his head a little wistfully and continued. I'd like to shoot an elk, he said. Make me feel part of something. Make you feel part Republican, says another player. Imagine that, Pharaoh said, laughing huskily. Half a dozen brothers go up to Montana, looking right, showing dignity, shooting at some elk. Why don't that happen? I'm just saying, we shouldn't shut ourselves out. This America. That's a rousing affirmation of American possibility, but because Ride Around Shining is so cleverly retracing Gatsby's doomed route, we readers are clued in that there's a limit to what even the most high-flying basketball player here is going to achieve. Ride Around Shining is an often provocative read. It wouldn't be my first-round draft pick, but it's got game.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Ride Around Shining by Chris Leslie Heinen. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
You may feel you've heard enough stories about Ukraine to last the rest of the summer. Today, we've got one more. But hang on. This story is not about pro-Russian separatists or airplane disasters. In fact, this Ukraine story is not a tragedy at all. It's sort of a comedy.
For those who have only imagined the scene inside a ladies' locker room, the actuality was a handful of half-squatting women struggling with their locks. The floor was wet and contaminated seeming. A woman came in with hair piled on her crown like a scoop of ice cream about to tip. One side of her bathing suit had ridden up a dimpled buttock, exposing skin that was soaked, shapeless, pinkish, like whale blubber.
That's Yelena Akhtyorskaya reading from her debut novel, Panic in a Suitcase. The book is divided between the Ukrainian city of Odessa and the dingy Oceanside neighborhood of Brighton Beach, New York. It centers around a family of immigrants to the United States, much like Akhtyorskaya's own family, who settled in Brighton Beach and brought their culture with them from Odessa.
Basically, it's all the same Russian Jews from Odessa. It's the same stores, lots of stores called Odessa. The stores sell the same strange squirrel candies.
Squirrel candies?
They're called Bielichka, which means squirrel, and they have a little picture of the squirrel on them. And I guess they're full of nuts and chocolate.
And within the novel, you have this family that hasn't even managed to immigrate in full. They are trying to get Pasha to come over. He comes over for a visit. He won't stay. Even the act of immigration seems to be an incomplete act.
Yeah, when the family leaves, it's still the Soviet Union, and they think, you know, they're going past the Iron Curtain, and that's it. There's really going to be no going back. And then very, very soon afterwards, the Soviet Union dissolves, and they can get their son or the uncle, Pasha, to come and visit them. And it's a completely different thing. He can go and scope out the premises and see, do I want to come here? Do I not want to come here?
Tell us about the character Pasha. I understand he is based on an uncle of yours in real life?
Yes. That's hard to admit.
Nobody's listening. Go. You just confide in me. It's okay.
Well, Pasha, he is head in the clouds, intellectual. He is a poet, and he has disappointed his family in many ways. He's converted to Christianity. He has become a poet as opposed to a doctor. You know, it's a family of doctors. He hasn't married the Jewish girl, and he stays in Odessa. And he's the kind of person who can recite the whole canon of Russian poetry, but he can't tie his shoelaces.
Even beyond Pasha, so many of the characters in this novel, from the central family to the people they run into on the street, are hilarious and also seem like people I would not want to spend any time with. Was it difficult to write about characters that to some extent reflect your family in ways that were so unflinching?
Yes, and I had to do it thinking that there was no chance in the world that anybody was ever going to read this.
So what happened when they did?
My mother said that when she was reading parts of it, she was just sort of sweating, this cold sweat. But I think that after all, she's proud. And I think slowly after reading it, she sees it as an accomplishment in the way that immigrant parents are wont to do.
The Washington Post called this book "The Great Immigrant Story Drained of Its Inspirational Hype." Does that describe the way you see this book?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of see it as an anti-immigrant immigrant novel. I don't see immigration as something where you come to the new country and, you know, you have all these incredible opportunities and it's so much better than the old place and you just forge ahead. My question is, maybe it's better to stay behind than come to the new country. Or maybe not that it's better, but it has its own rewards.
Is it difficult to reconcile the Ukraine you see on the news with the Ukraine of your writing and your life experience?
It's practically impossible. That's why I feel so conflicted whenever I go back to visit. One moment, it seems to me like the most beautiful city in the world and exactly, you know, where my soul belongs and where I naturally just came from. And the next moment, it seems completely foreign and strange and also maybe paltry and a bit crumbling. So it's very hard to reconcile. And when I write about it, I feel like I have to try to stave off the completely romanticized idea that I have of it.
I know that this is your first novel and it has just come out, but given that you wrote it before any of this began, do you think any novels you might write going forward will be changed by current events in Ukraine right now?
I do think so. Even now, as I'm writing stories, I can't seem to go back and access that pure Odessa of the imagination that I had before that was completely untethered to reality and to current events, which is hard because I have to figure out now how to write about it, but certainly it's completely changed.
That's Yelena Akhtyorskaya, author of the new novel, Panic in a Suitcase. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ari.
Romani Conti is one of the most famed vineyards in the world, in history really, where they produce one of the most elegant and extravagantly priced wines in the world. In January of 2010, Albert Duvillin, the famed proprietor, got a threat to his livelihood, if not his life. Pay more than €1 million in ransom, or his Burgundy vines that have produced wines famed all over the world would be poisoned. Maximilian Potter first wrote about this plot for Vanity Fair magazine. He's been a staff writer for Premier and GQ magazines and is now senior media advisor to the governor of Colorado. His new book, Shadows in the Vineyard, the true story of the plot to poison the world's greatest wine. Maximilian Potter joins us from member station KUVO in Denver. Thanks so much for being with us.
My immense pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me.
First off, how good is this wine?
Without being overly hyperbolic, it's definitely the finest flavor I've ever had in my mouth. I drank it, and I was immediately filled with an incredible warmth, and it just seemed like something that was alive and wonderful and warm.
Tell us about the Grand Monsieur of this wine, Albert Duvillin. This is his wine. This is his family.
I'll give you the before and after, Scott. Before I went to Burgundy and I had the opportunity to meet him. In my mind's eye, I saw, you know, a soft-palmed, ascot-wearing French aristocrat who probably didn't spend too much time in the vines and delegated the real work. And when I met him, within a very short period of talking to him, it was abundantly clear to me just how wrong I had been. He's one of the first to work in the morning. He's one of the last to leave. He drives the French version of a very economically priced station wagon. I thought of him at different times as a kind of Sam Walton, almost, in terms of his work ethic and demeanor.
So the Grand Monsieur comes home one night, and there's a cardboard cylinder addressed to him.
Yeah.
And a map and a note inside. What was that about?
Well, first he looks at the map and he recognizes it immediately to be a map of Romani Conti, the crown jewel of France's vineyards and certainly his crown jewel of the Domaine de la Romani Conti. He sees a very detailed drawing of the vineyard. Every single vine is marked, and then he opens a note and it informs him that there's a plot underway that is attacking his vines. And that if he wants his vines to live, to stay tuned for another note where the bad guy or bad guys at this time, no one knew who they were, was going to make clear their demands and how those demands could be met.
Did it become a matter of national importance to the French National Police to find the alleged perps?
Yes. After Monsieur Duvillin received the first note, his initial reaction was to dismiss it as a joke in horribly bad taste. When he received the second note, which laid out in certain terms just exactly what was going on and foreshadowed the possibility of the devastation in a way that Monsieur Duvillin could not ignore, then he began to think about, how do I deal with this? And so he didn't mess around, and he called the French version of the FBI, which is the Police Nationale. Mm-hmm. And within minutes of talking with Monsieur Duvillin, the inspector on the other end knew right away how serious this was, and he went to the head of the Police Nationale, who at the time was a fellow by the name of Christian Lothian, and he dispatched his best investigators from Paris to Burgundy to oversee this investigation.
As I guess you would in any investigation, they had a few wild goose chases, didn't they?
The investigators had quite a few wild goose chases, and the first one was through a mix. The police were tracing one of the packages through the French version of Federal Express, and there was a coding mistake that was made, and they descended on this one poor fellow who was coming home from work at a plumbing supply shop, And it turned out that he was ordering an Xbox.
Yeah. PlayStation or something, right?
A PlayStation. Right. It was a PlayStation. And just when the police were starting to get demoralized is when they had their breakthrough.
How did they ultimately get on the right track and plan a sting operation?
Well, the investigation after several goose chases were reaching a point where they really were beginning to turn their attention toward the serious possibility that it was an inside job. Mm-hmm. At that moment, they received the final of several notes from the bad guys, and it directed them to place 1 million euro in cash in a suitcase and deliver it to the cemetery in the town of Chambol-Musigny, which is a small hamlet just to the north of Vosne-Romanée. And the plan was that because Monsieur de Villene was out of town, Jean-Charles Cuvier, his right-hand man, volunteered to be the bag man. He carried in a bag of counterfeit cash into the cemetery, and shortly thereafter, one of the bad guys emerged to come and collect it, and that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah. As it turns out, the man ultimately arrested, it turns out to be behind the plot. Let me just put it this way. We're not exactly talking about John Dillinger here, are we?
No. He wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer. His name is Jacques Soltis. Mm-hmm. The plan that he enacted really wasn't his idea. Mm-hmm. He had been a career criminal and
To be a career criminal. It sounds like he kept striking out. He was a career prisoner.
Did. He was a career prisoner. That's fair.
Yeah.
And during his last stint inside, someone gave him the idea, hey, in Burgundy, they treat their vineyards as sacrosanct, and most of them are French noblemen and aristocrats. They don't like gossip. They're wealthy. You could probably extort them, threaten them, and get them to pay you mm-hmm. just to have them go away. Once basically the plan became his, he undid himself. And that he's the guy that planned the bag drop-off in the cemetery of the middle of the night. There's any number of ways. I mean, they could have done a digital transfer. He set himself up for failure, for sure.
Yeah. Mr. Potter, is Romani Conti, if anything, even a little more precious today?
Well, you know, every year, Burgundy as a region, the prices are going up and up and up, unlike Bordeaux, by the way. In terms of a more existential value in Burgundy, in France, and with enophiles around the world, I think there's a renewed appreciation for what it represents and for the philosophies and spirituality and tenderness and care and history that are all tangled in the vines of Romani Conti.
And to be absolutely plain, if you have some, you don't, like, mix it with club soda, right?
No, you want to drink that straight, Scott.
Maximilian Potter, his new book, Shadows in the Vineyard, the true story of the plot to poison the world's greatest wine. Mr. Potter, thanks so much.
My immense pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Some journeys are more life-changing than others. For migrants, the movement from one home to the next can be filled with anticipation, struggle, and drama, all of which can make a compelling story. For our series, Book Your Trip, NPR's Bilal Qureshi explores the inspiration many writers find in the immigrant experience.
Novelist Amitav Ghosh was born in India. He studied in England and now lives in Brooklyn.
Travel has become so commonplace. We just get onto planes and get off, and, you know, nobody even really interacts with their surroundings very much anymore. But to me, to this day, even though I still travel a lot, that moment when a plane takes off, it's incredibly thrilling.
That thrill inspired a trilogy of novels about the opium wars of the 19th century. The star of the books is an old-fashioned sailing ship named the Ibis. Its second officer is a mixed-race American.
To his eye, there was something unusually graceful about the Ibis's yacht-like rigging, with the sails aligned along her length rather than across the line of her hull. He could see why, with her main and headsail standing fair, she might put someone in mind of a white-winged bird in flight.
As the Ibis sails to Mauritius, India, and China, a global cast of characters assembles on board.
Every ship was, in a sense, a microcosm of the world.
Ghosh says he was inspired by Herman Melville's Moby Dick.
This is one of Melville's great themes, you know, how completely different kinds of people are thrust together and how very often their roles just completely change.
Change is also at the heart of Jan Martel's best-selling novel, Life of Pi. And its Oscar-winning film adaptation. An Indian boy sailing to Canada with his family survives a shipwreck. He's lost at sea on a lifeboat with a tiger. They must learn to coexist, and they forge a community of survivors.
We were both raised in a zoo by the same master. Now we've been orphaned, left to face our ultimate master together.
The notion of shipwreck in the life of Pi, I think, is a perfect metaphor for the experience of exile.
Reza Aslan is a best-selling author who lives in Los Angeles.
Being adrift, looking for a land to call home, that's an experience that I myself have experienced as an exile from Iran.
Aslan says Life of Pi shows how the immigrant's journey leaves an individual unmoored, how it throws an identity into flux. The idea of how immigrants reconcile their past with the future inspired Jhumpa Lahiri's novel, The Namesake, which also became a film. In it, a father survives a traumatic train accident as a young man in India. In America, he tells his son why he still thinks about that fateful night.
Do I remind you of that night?
Not at all. You remind me of everything that followed. Every day since then has been a gift.
We have to go through that darkness, through that chaos and confusion.
Ilan Stavins is a professor of literature at Amherst College.
In order to come to the other side and maybe, ultimately figure out that the person that we are today still has fragments of the person that we were before we immigrated.
Stavins edited an anthology of writing called Becoming Americans.
What immigrant writers have done in American literature is showed us that America is a microcosm of the world, that all cultures converge here, that we have connections, tentacles to the rest of the world, and that we are a society in constant movement.
That movement is very much in the headlines today, and it was the subject for Sonia Nazario's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Enrique's Journey. Nazario followed a young boy from Honduras searching for his mother in the United States.
And he travels the only way that he can with little or no money, which is gripping on to the tops and the sides of these freight trains that travel up the length of Mexico. It's a modern-day odyssey that these children go on.
And it's a book of reporting written with a novelist's eye.
There were gangsters that controlled the train tops, and I would see these guys. They would roam from car to car and surround a group of migrants and say, you know, your money or your life, and strip you of your clothes, look for any coins they can find, sometimes hurdle you down to the churning wheels below.
The train will be in your dreams forever.
Again, Ilan Stavins.
And you will have to make sense of that train one way or another as you become an adult.
But writer Reza Aslan says these stories of migration aren't really about the external journey.
It doesn't matter the mode of transportation, whether by foot or by camel or by car or by plane. It doesn't matter the destination. And even the journey itself is secondary to the transformation that occurs in the individual making the journey.
And even for the individual sitting still, reading about those journeys can become its own means of transformation. Bilal Qureshi, NPR News.